Does anyone have a question or anything to say from what's happened so far? Yes.
I can mention this later to you, but I was just wondering if you could mention or talk a little bit more about something that I find a tension between sort of there not being a need for perfection or perfection already being perfect, but then knowing that there is something out there like Shorthart's release that we're aspiring for.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we, you know, not, yeah, like it does seem precise kind of thing.
Yeah.
And yet, yeah.
Could everyone hear? So this is where the second kind of knowing from yesterday, so not just curiosity, kind of testing out different spiritual techniques and then forgetting about losing our momentum and, oh, well, let's try this other one that's now in fashion. And knowing that we're not in the third kind of knowing where we are already, it's evident that there is non-separation. In between, another way to talk about it is something that keeps on digging. And trusting that. So one of my favorite spiritual stories is of a woman who was, she felt that inspiration towards something great, we can say. And she was willing to do what needed to be done, so she did some practices and she had really deep states of meditation come, that we would be like, woo, we're done. And she knew she wasn't done. So staying with that digging. So even when we can celebrate and rejoice, like, wow, this is great. But something keeps digging at the same time. And there are two words that got my interest today, sort of out of the blue, that I think are related to that digging. And one is audacity, and the kind of audacity to make room for change. So not the audacity to just like really be myself as I already know myself, but to really let something that I've never known before happen. And we start to more and more experience moments where even the sense of I almost comes like a tag after the fact. And so the sense of I that, oh, I did it, or this is happening to me, or I'm doing badly, or I'm doing well, is so not intrinsic to what's happening. It's like a tag that gets put on after everything has been done. And is also not a problem. It's just another aspect of human experience that comes up. So the audacity to be fully ourselves, which means the audacity to not be myself, as I know myself. And apparently the root of the word audacity, the roots, it goes through an interesting evolution. And if we go in reverse, audacity. Before that is avere, that is wanting, like greed. And before that, it's so lovely, is a word for thanks. Thanks, like thank you. And a word for gentleness. So a kind of, there's gentleness and thanks that come. And then of course we want. In that sense of avid, I'm an avid meditator because I want that gentleness that I just felt. And if we could kind of feel through to the root of the word and let the root inform what's happening, the root of there's thanks and there's gentleness, and that is what makes space for change to happen. For some change meaning something unexpected, something unpredictable. One of my favorite definitions of Open Dharma, over the years we try to make different mission statements to try to describe what it is, which it isn't a thing, so it's really fun to try to describe something that's not a thing. one of the definitions is a group that's dedicated to help us live a life without regret, to come to a way of living that we do not live with regret. And it doesn't mean that we're just unfeeling and we don't care that we keep hurting people and ourselves, but that we're not repeating what we know to be hurtful gestures or whatever. So the audacity to not repeat. And I like how this happens in my mind, that the two words that came to me for this talk have a lot to do with what you're asking and are a really nice combination, because the second word is obedience. Audacity and obedience, audacious obedience. And as I was swimming with the word obedience and knowing what that word does to us, the way we know the word now, and letting the word obedience kind of ring in my mind as I was swimming in the pond with words from the texts of Buddhism, where they talk about, as we've talked about over the last few days, what we can work with in the mind so that there's less blocking our experience of what is. And they talk about that as we let go of the sense of not being enough and don't let that move us so often, as we more often tap into the sense of being a resource, even if we don't know how to go from here. The mind that could be blocking our experience of what is, the mind starts to become malleable. So it's like when you work the clay and it gets softer and softer. Wieldy, which I love how they use this kind of archaic English. Malleable, wieldy, and bright. And I like the combination. Malleable, like the earth could be. And maybe only the earth could be so malleable. And wieldy gives the sense of some kind of tool, so that we could actually, so instead of our usual armoring that's so stiff that we can hardly move, something that's wieldy, so that actually we could play around with all of our protections, and we could question, what are we protecting after all? And then we see what we're holding in our hands in a different way. It's not a sword after all. And bright. Malleable, wieldy, and bright. That's possible with this very mind might be shocking news. But that's what they say. So that was kind of ringing in my head as I swam, obedience and the possibility of a mind that's malleable, wieldy, and bright. Where would brightness come from? Is there any, in your inspection of the mind, have you found brightness? Where does it come from? If the mind could be bright. So, of course, I also looked at the roots of the word obedience. Already having the feeling for me of disobedience, so disobeying the rules and the habits. And I really loved what was there. Maybe they're wrong, but this is what people think were the roots of the word obedience. So ab is leaning, inclining towards. And I don't know how it would be pronounced, the odidi and then the asthenestai in Greek, to perceive. So first it's leaning towards what we hear. You can hear ab odidi, like ab auditory, leaning towards what we hear, what's audible. And then where audible came from is just what we perceive. Leaning towards what's evident is another way of putting it. An inclination towards what's obvious. Inclining towards the whisper of what's true. So there was also this, every once in a while, there's this Sanskrit root in there. We forget that Sanskrit is in our family of languages. And there's also obvious, evident. So leaning towards the evident. Leaning towards the evidence, if only we could if we could really take into account the evidence and not what we keep repeating to ourselves. The evidence is, for example, in August, when we thought of changing the timing of the talk because it was going to be so hot. We have the windows open, and I'm still wondering if I'm going to put my blanket on. The evidence is this: we cannot predict. We cannot know in the way we'd like to. We don't need to lean on that. Leaning on that, we will fall. Leaning on that, we will regret. So this can give room for an investigation of what's actually important. And we've talked about this already a few times. Letting go of what we think others want us to do, letting go of what we think others think is important, which is an audacious act. And it's not a rejection of people, and it's not a rejection of the fact that we need each other. But we don't need each other's opinions about what's important very much. We do need each other. We need each other's encouragement. We need each other's warmth. And we need each other to each find what's important from the inside, inclining towards the whisper. Inclining towards a different kind of evidence. So it's kind of like, instead of going back to the files and what we have recorded about the evidence, actually going to the evidence. Going to what evidence we have now about what is. And there are two kinds of evidence, at least. There's some evidence that we are habitual creatures, and that it doesn't always do us so good. And there's evidence that we have the freedom that we can leave the habit in a second. We might leave the habit another second later, in a second. But it's in that second that we can leave the habit. And I received another important question today that's really related also to Michal's question. When we're aware of a habit, and we're aware that it's a painful habit, so we're not in that illusion that we had yesterday where there's a snake and we think it's a rope. We've realized we're addicted to something and it's hurting us and others. The most common addiction, the most basic addiction, is the addiction to recognition from other people. So we've realized it's actually a snake that we're holding on now onto, and now what do? We've kind of put on a special glove that wouldn't let us let go. Gotta get the glove off. Gotta get our armor off. We've gotta let the implements be wieldy. And so the question was, how do I know if I should just be with what's happening? Knowing that it's painful, knowing that it's an addiction, knowing that I can't see very clearly. And how do I know when to do something against the habit? How do I know when to do something in that literally, obviously audacious kind of way? And we came to a lovely kind of way of talking about it as when the being and doing are together, so the doing can just happen. And the being is not this job, that other kind of obedience, the old kind of obedience, where I'm supposed to be just being with the discomfort. If we could let go of that, supposed to be, and feel what we can live. Even if many times we don't live what we can, if we stay where the being and doing are one thing, so there's more, it's more malleable, it's more wieldy, and just check and see if it's more bright. There's a story that I love that talks about malleable, wieldy, and bright in a I was going to say clever way, a way that can really help us get through our ideas of, we're so literal sometimes when we want to stick to a habit. Obedience, audacity, being with, doing something about. Once upon a time, there was a tree. And under the tree sat a person in meditation. Not too far from that tree was another tree. Under that tree sat another person, also in meditation. A dastardly wise person who knew how to fly, named Narada, so Narada, happened to be flying by, as you do, and noticed the two trees, and noticed some brightness, and noticed two people, and went to check what was going on, kind of hanging out in the trees, and decided to play a trick, to deliberately deceive as a teaching. And this is something that happens. It might be illegal in America, but maybe that's why it might be good to leave America sometimes to get another perspective. Some teachers, including one of mine, deliberately deceives and makes the biggest mess possible. And in the end, people come out smiling. The end might take a few years to get to, but it's not something that I welcome, but it does seem to work. Okay, so I have asked him to find a better way. So Narada was this kind of dastardly guy, and he deliberately told a lie to both of these people. He told them the same lie, more or less. He said, hey, brought them out of their meditation. Do you see how many leaves are in this tree? I see you're meditating there, by the way. You see how many leaves are in this tree? That's how many lifetimes it's going to take before you get enlightened. Bye. And he was gone. And the first person went into an ecstatic dance. And the second person was cursing and throwing in the meditative towel. The first person in the ecstatic dance, so glad to be able to continue the lovely practice that the person was engaged in, because there was not a supposed to involved. Of course, got enlightened in that instant. And the poor other person who made the mistake of believing something that he or she was told instead of going back to the evidence didn't get enlightened instantly. And we can make up the rest of the story for ourselves. I think it's so good to know that gossip doesn't only and primarily happen between people, but it happens mostly inside our head and our poor heart. Our heart's not really made to stand that much gossip. I saw a really funny study recently where people were trying to measure the effect of gossip on our perceptions, on how we take in the evidence. And it was this really funny, they had the display of people's faces, so just like this, nothing else. That itself made me crack up. So eight little faces like this. And then the poor people who had were probably getting paid whatever per hour to do the study, so they were glad to do it, were told different descriptions of the people. And one of them was threw a chair across the room at someone else. One of them was helped someone across the street. And then there were neutral ones as well. Just one statement per face, a different one per face. And then people were asked to look at something that had two images at once. And it was the image of the face and the image of something else. And we can't see two things at once. So our inner workings decides for us what we're going to see. And when we've heard negative gossip about a face, not even someone, but about the face, then our attention went to that person's face much more often than in any other scenario. So our defenses are up before we even can decide what to let in. When we hear negative gossip, we're on alert and we notice that person that we've heard it about, even though we're doing a psychological study and we know it's not a true statement. So what about when we think that we're being told the truth? When we think that we're telling the truth inside. As if truth could be told. If we could have a different kind of practice of coming back again to the evidence, rather than to how we summarize the evidence. It leaves room for that second kind of knowing that does the digging for us. So we're not just at the mercy of the reactive knowing that doesn't even make the list in the Sanskrit list of three kinds of knowing. The reactive knowing we can call Vedana, another word with roots. I was about to come out with a tongue twister, another rude with warts, we could say. Another word with roots. It is rude with warts, our Vedana. And it comes, the word Vedana comes from the word vid, which is to know. But it's not a genuine knowing. It's knowing from the records we've taken from what's actually happened. It's knowing according to what our defenses say rather than according to what life says. So Vedana is how we take in the world as if it's either against us, for us, or neutral. So just like in the psychological test. Everything that happens, any thought in our mind, any sound, any color, etc. We don't let it be. It is required to come in through one of the three doors. Friend, foe, or unimportant, because it's neither a threat nor of help, according to our system. How much help that blocks out, all those dastardly geniuses flying around who want to trick us into enlightenment. And how much hurt it opens us to when we think something's of help, so the snake that we think is a rope. It's important to find, to uncover, what it would be that we wouldn't want to stop doing, that we would be delighted if someone said, you get to keep doing this for about 10,000 more lifetimes. What is that for you? And doing the work of taking off all those wet blankets of things that we think we're supposed to do, that we're doing because it's good for us. And it might even be good for us if we would be doing it genuinely, like willingly, audaciously, with that other kind of obedience, where there's something that in us does lean towards the whisper, towards that kind of brightness. That's part of what I love about the description of the mind's possibility to end up being malleable, wieldy, and bright, because it sounds like a mind that has kind of dropped into contact with light. And isn't there something that you've done already in your life that you love to do that you can love to do so much that even when it's really hard and it really sucks, you don't want to stop. There's an image from one of my favorite books on the planet, the Yogvashishta, of a wedding lamp. So in India, that would be a kind of brass lamp, probably whatever metal you like, or clay. A lamp that has oil. And the wedding lamp has two wicks that you make by hand. You just twist the cotton, and it still has seeds in it sometimes. Just twist it. You keep twisting it until this big puff of cotton gets really small, and it starts to curl around on itself, and then you fold it into two. It's a double twist. And you put it in the oil, and it soaks up the oil, and you then can light the wick. It would be like there's a wick that is already bright. So we've talked about how our perfection is not made imperfect by our imperfections in the last few days. That no matter how awful we behave, how terribly behaved our mind is, how constricted our heart is, no matter what happens, our deep okayness is untouched. There is something of human dignity that we can experience as okayness or even bliss that is untouchable. And it doesn't mean that we want horrible things to happen to everyone to prove that. But even when horrible things happen, there is that dignity that's untouchable. I don't mind if you stay here.
I just need to have a bit.
Okay. And in the text, there's the talk about this work. I think as a wedding lamp, both wicks are burning, both wicks are bright. So some kind of brightness in the mind and some kind of brightness in our true nature, let's call it. And then in the ceremony of the wedding, it's this using a golden wire to just ever so gently, without putting out either one of them, bringing the two together to be one flame. And this is a ritual that happens, but it was used in the text as a metaphor for what we're doing here. Bringing two flames together so gently as to not put one or the other out until it's one thing. One brightness. One of my friends here gave me a wonderful quotation by another one of my spiritual teachers that I never met. This one is Dogen. Being unstained is like meeting a person and not considering what that person looks like. Meeting someone and not taking into account what the person looks like. So when we talk about an inclination towards the evidence, towards what is evident, and we have this possibility that there's this other kind of evidence that's more important than what someone looks like. That our relation to what someone looks like is just a bunch of gossip that we know to be inaccurate. And so we develop our willingness to hear the other evidence, and we can. Many times it seems like we can't, and we can. Sometimes just coming back to that possibly I can is from the same Sanskrit text, the same part about the wedding lamp. There's this lovely line about a trickle of trust. I don't know what the original Sanskrit word is right now, but my friend Ajay translated as a trickle of trust. And that this woman who was doing all this deep practice and not thinking, not believing the gossip that she was kind of perfected and not losing track of her perfection, letting the digging go on and on. Via the trickle of trust. That there's some other evidence that we can incline towards. And I love the sense of bowing that comes with inclining towards. A kind of respect for seeing what's invisible through the bright eyes of the belly. And along the way, she was asked, probably by some more dastardly flying enlightened people, she was asked to come into the next phase of her practice, to leave behind what had been helpful so far. It had been so helpful. So there was thanks for that gentleness, that audacity, leaving that behind. And being in the gap where you're no longer an expert at that, at that form of gentleness, and you don't know what's going on. And then a new phase of practice begins. It might be where you feel your intuition or how you feel it. Maybe it changes from a sensation to a brightness, or maybe it becomes a sensation brightness, and maybe it moves from your belly to your heart or to your head or to your lower back. When we're at the beginning, we have such a good chance to feel a kind of humility that's not humiliating, which is a kind of openness, really. And we could be more in touch with our willingness. So she was in touch with her willingness, and she was asked to commit to the next phase of practice. Signing a contract was the image that was used for what it would be like. But she puts her name on the line, she signs the contract, and it has a certain amount of time that needs to go on. So, 10,000 lifetimes, signing on the dotted line, gladly. 10,000 lifetimes gone, feeling kind of lost. What comes next? Signing again. It's not wrong of us when there are those days that we're like, oh no, not again. I have to cut through this anger again. I have to find gentleness again. I'm so tired of this. When will it ever stop? It's just a sign of unwieldiness. It's just a sign of some defense that hasn't found its new life, its new usage. That it doesn't need to fend off life. But to find a true kind of openness, not a symbolic openness, but a true kind of openness. Opening to more of the evidence of what we are. There was a Sufi guy who had some kind of experiential wisdom gesture where he ripped his robes open. And so then he looked like some kind of scraggly guy. And only his teacher could see what was going on. Only his teacher could avoid the gossip, could be bored of the gossip, just disinterested. Maybe not even bored of it. may be ready to use the gossip in some helpful way. But his teacher heard that he called his broken robes Faraji. I don't know how to pronounce it. I don't know if anyone knows. Faraji. How to say it? Faraji. Faraji. It's funny how it's a talk of words and where they come from. There are different meanings. Faraji means ripped open. It also means happiness. It also means one who brings the joy of being opened. So this is what he named his broken robe. Already, like someone that would name his robe, we might kind of be like, I heard you ripped your robe, Kurt, and gave it a name. Bye. We might not remember that Faraji doesn't just mean ripped open, it means happiness, and it means one who brings the joy of being opened. One who gives us, who relieves us of the burdensome practice of worrying and of all the other ways of defending. The stem of Faraji, Faraj, also refers to the male and female genitals, just to make it even more like, maybe I better get out of here. Or maybe I want to stay. More human. If we can kind of be awakened to our own eyes that can see through the gossip, even the gossip of our past experiences that happened once or a few times or even many times, but maybe aren't happening now. There's a lovely line in this verses on Faith Mind that I faithfully bring every day, thinking I'm going to do a talk on this. When no discriminating attachment arises, I think we better go into that line before I continue so that we can hear the second half of the sentence. I like how the translator has said, when no discriminating attachment arises, because discrimination in the sense of being able to feel the evidence of what's helpful, what's wholesome, what's unwholesome, what's venomous, etc., what's medicine. That also comes from our deep eyes. We can feel the evidence, what's wholesome and unwholesome. So that's a kind of discrimination that's helpful, that does arise. It does kind of dawn on us that we better get out of here, or we would be well off to stay. But we usually stop our true discrimination and we allow discriminating attachment, in other words, gossip, to arise. And then it doesn't leave room for this, the deep eyes. When we use our reactive knowing, vedana, then we're stuck in the old mind. And when no discriminating attachment arises, the old mind ceases to exist. Let go of things as separate existences, and mind too vanishes. So it can change our picture of what's happening. It's not so much like picking away at the old mind. But whenever we can breathe a little space for our deeper discrimination, our deeper knowing, the digging, to happen to us. the more we start to experience the old mind that as something that could cease to exist, that could vanish. That whole way of living could become irrelevant. It's almost not fair to say become. Suddenly is irrelevant. It usually happens that there might be some small glimpses or clues that something's happening as we keep inclining towards the whisper and making space for that to lead us with the trickle of trust. When that happens, those experiences are so light-handed, so malleable, wieldy, and bright, that it's hard to take them into account compared to all the heaviness, the burdensome practice of judging, which brings annoyance and weariness, according to Saint San in the Verses of Faith Mind. The burdensome practice of judging which has brought annoyance and weariness to people for thousands of years. So it's not just you. Is so heavy, so that the gossip is so easy to feel, so easy to lean that way. But isn't it also, in a way, easy to lean another way? And to start to get the hang of the different kind of leaning, the different feeling of leaning or being sucked into the habit, the burdensome practice. And the sometimes terrifying, might be sometimes terrifying, leaning into the whisper. Leaning into where there doesn't seem to be anything to support you. According to the old mind, there is nothing to support you. According to the new kind of, the freshest evidence, right now there's still support, and right now there's still support, and right now there's still support, and right now there's still support. There doesn't seem to be support ready, like, where's everybody? Where's the team of doctors to catch me? I'm about to fall. Hello, universe. But in this moment, there is some support that comes out of nowhere. Saint San also says, those who rely on limited views are fearful and irresolute. We know that too. If we could take that as evidence to inspire us, to save our energy and to invest our energy wisely. To save our energy from trying to do what's important to me and what's important to you in my life. Because there's not really two lives in the one life, there's just the one. And when I'm following what's important to me, leaning into the whisper, I find out how important you are to me. Also. If we could take the evidence that where we've been investing our energy in the old mind, it's not just wasting that energy. It's like developing a momentum of exhaustion. Developing a momentum to suck more energy. And when we kind of lean towards this other brightness, there's not even any smoke to help us find the brightness. It's called a lamp without oil in the texts. It doesn't even use energy to be bright. We start to remember more of the glimpses and clues that have come about what's actually happening. We start to be more susceptible to that lightness, even silliness. And how much care can happen, and how much patience can happen with a sense of humor. As we let the two flames get closer and closer. The glimpses of a less limited experience of what we are. The glimpses of maybe the body is living cells, and also sometimes as if like an image in water that's so sensitive that the tiniest movement ripples throughout the whole body, or the body as light. As we start to notice what are the areas in our lives where we fear we can't receive support, or have never received support. And sometimes we blame me and sometimes we blame you. Feeling that painful, protected place that's scared. It doesn't know that it belongs, that it can be here. And noticing the patterns of where are you compulsively supporting others, and where are you compulsively trying to get support, maybe not quite letting it in, maybe so tuned to that neediness, that lack, that it's like trying to fill a tub with the drain open. And as we let the digging happen, which another word for the digging is like a quest towards the unlimited, an echo of a sense that we are somehow also unlimited, even in our very limitation. The compulsions of giving and receiving support, and again, another word, dharma, can be translated to mean support. Support that's not separate from us, a support that gives life. As we're less tuned into our gossip about how we must support in order to be liked, or how we must receive, we must be needy in order to get anything in this world. We start to find that there keeps being support. There keeps being what we need. And we're in tune with dharma. And the old mind ceases to exist. What Eckhart Tolle calls the pain body. So like all the memories of our pain that come on every time we get scratched. Ceases to exist. First, it less and less often gossips to us, and less do we believe it. More and more is there tenderness to receive it. But it's not quite this linear process where we keep healing spot by spot. It's also that audacity that we all belong so much. We can relax that much. And that the digging goes on much better that way. It's not that when I relax so much, I just zone out. And when I wake up, I start doing my thing again. What we really need to be doing, not like because we should, but because we need, like we need air, water, and food, and love, and touch, and each other. We need to be doing something. And when we're doing what we need to be doing, we're in tune with Dharma, we're in support. We're supporting and supported. And we don't care, we're not keeping track there. We're the host and the guest. Are there any questions or comments? Anything you'd like to add?
Jai, I admit I'm still beautifully confused about this. And could you say a little bit more about, you're using the phrase, or you're referencing the phrase of old mind, and I'm curious if mind in this context is what we think of as mind, or if it's, as it is in some other places, a word that we can, that can be more expansive of experience.
I don't mean it today like, I mean, it's just quoting Saint San, but I don't mean it today like in Tibetan Buddhism. Tibetan Buddhism. The words are going crazy today. In Tibetan Buddhism, mind could be, when it's free, the same as what is. I don't mean that. Because this is something that ceases to exist. And that's something that neither comes into being nor departs. But I would also say it's not only, old mind is not only what we know about our mind, but also this part about Vedana, which we don't know much about. We haven't paid that much attention because we're so afraid. So we so are trying to get the help and trying to keep the hurt out and so hurting ourselves in that way. So if we can include that unexplored territory that we can explore, it's not like that part is unknown but knowable. The filters that are in place. That's also part of the old mind that ceases to inform us. Yeah? Okay. So thank you for being here.